All right. Good morning, listeners, and welcome to News from the Drug War Front. My name is Jeff, and my co-presenter is Marion. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeffrey, and good morning, listener. And how are we all going on this beautiful morning?
Aside from a little bit of wind, it is beautiful, isn't it?
Oh, gorgeous. And wasn't that rain yesterday just welcome? It smelt so nice afterwards, but boy, did it pelt down.
I think of lots more of that would be nice before
I should do
summer.
The weather every time we come on. I feel like that's the first thing I do every time we come on air. Marianne plus weather.
Well, most people want to know what's going on.
Well, we're just inside a studio, but we know it's what it's like outside, believe me.
Actually, I was thinking about the weather. Funny you should mention it. You know, like you watch weather reports and they're talking about X and Y being above or below average.
Yeah.
Well, really, those averages are pretty much irrelevant now.
Yes.
Like with climate change.
Yeah. What is average?
We're getting records of all kinds all the time. So it's saying this is it. You know.
All over the top, isn't it, Jeffrey? And the last 12 months, particularly last financial year, has been a nightmare in terms of what's normal and what's not normal. Just we haven't got that anymore. You're right. It just doesn't exist normal. Anyhow. Not our show. Let's go on to our show.
I just hope it's not a brutal summit like last year.
Oh, anyway. Wouldn't that be a shocker?
All right, welcome listeners to News from the Drug War Front, brought to you by CARMA, the Canberra Alliance for Harm Minimisation and Advocacy, which is Canberra's peer-based drug user organisation. Now, the aim of the show, Marion and I hope to inform and educate listeners about...
Marion hopes to do it. Jeffrey, no, he does.
Well, between us, we...
We struggle a little.
A fair fist of it, yeah. Hope to educate listeners about the failure of the war on drugs, or to describe it more accurately, the war on people who use drugs. So aside from that, we also promote the services offered by CARMA and also other agencies in the alcohol and other drug sector in the ACT.
And CARMA is the Canberra Alliance for Harm Minimisation and Advocacy. It's Canberra's only peer-based drug user group. CARMA provides a wide range of services, including client advocacy, peer treatment support, education, representation, information, creative arts, mentoring and referrals. The CARMA office is located in the Churches Centre at Level 1, Shop 17, 54 Belconnen Way in Belconnen. If you're on a rapid bus from Civic to Belconnen, get off at the community bus stop, which is the one just before the mall. Westfield. Across the road and you'll see a white building that is the Churches Centre. CARMA's office hours are 10 a.m. to 4 p.m, Monday to Friday. CARMA developed and ran the first trial of peer naloxone or Narcan program ever in Australia with 200 opioid users in Canberra. After a positive evaluation, new funding was granted and CARMA continues the education of opioid users and others, I might add, at regular opioid overdose recognition and response with naloxone workshops and also brief interventions with individual clients. Workers at other alcohol and other drug agencies in the ACT are also receiving that training. CARMA can assist with issues related to opioid maintenance treatment, that's methadone or buprenorphine, the availability of detox and rehab services in the ACT, the impact of stigma and discrimination, of which we are all subject to a lot, problems with getting access to proper pain relief, in fact, all issues faced by people impacted by prohibition and, quote, the war on people who use drugs.
Yes, and unfortunately it just continues on.
Doesn't it?
The contents of this News from the Drug War Front broadcast do not necessarily reflect the views and or the policies of the Canberra Alliance for Harm Minimisation and Advocacy, CARMA. CARMA does not condone, nor does it condemn drug use and does not promote illegal activity. CARMA recognises that drug use happens. As such, CARMA focuses on harm reduction messages, drug treatment support services, advocacy and community development. CARMA seeks to reduce the harms associated with drug use as well as the harms associated with the criminalisation of drug use through the provision of empowering programs that concentrate on community development, person-centred healthcare and equity of health service delivery for all people. And on that note, I'm very pleased that we're back into outreach after the lockdown.
That's good to hear.
I think We
started outreach activities at Illawarra Court.
Yes, yesterday
on
they
Monday
went out there.
And Wednesdays. So Illawarra Court.
Oaks Estate on Wednesday. But
yep.
We're slowly going to ramp up. We used to do Ainslie Village. There's a number of public housing estates that ACT Housing have asked us to come along and.
But at least finally we can get back to being with people.
Get back to connecting with.
Instead of only having this as an outreach to people. Nothing wrong with radio. We love the radio show. We love 2XX. We love people-powered radio. And we just wish that people would join 2XX, become a member, and you too can have your voice heard on people-powered radio.
And if you like our show and you do join, mention that that's one of the reasons why.
Indeed. Speaking of which, 6253. I used to remember that off by heart. That's Karma's number, by the way, 6253-3643. I keep forgetting to say that, but that's Karma's telephone number. Anytime between in Karma's business hours, get in touch with someone. They'll be available. Someone will be available to help you in whatever way you think is appropriate for you.
Absolutely. Now, look, before I play this first song, it's called Lay Down Your Sorrows by Johnny Winter, one of my favourite 70s blues guitarists. But, I was just having a chat with Colin Stoddart, who's on the Karma board, and he mentioned a fellow called Donnie who used to be in Canberra, in fact, befriended me when I moved up from Melbourne in 2004. Very lovely fellow, moved up north to Cairns, married, had two young kids, and he had a daughter from a previous relationship. Lovely fellow. Came back to Canberra and sadly he's no longer with us. Passed away. Yeah, passed away. And it just really floored me,
Socks off once again. And this was an overdose, do you think, Geoffrey?
As far as I could tell from...
And without wishing to, we don't badmouth people one way or another and certainly wouldn't want to do that to Donnie. If that was not the case, then sorry for saying so, but... We suspect that probably was the case. And we just seem to be losing people at a rate of knots. I mean, I think that the overdose rate, in Australia, in the ACT, I think we're going through it's one person every fortnight. I think we've had something like 52 deaths in the last 26 weeks, 26 fortnights. So, that's one a week. That's atrocious.
I'm wondering whether COVID is an aspect in this, Maren.
Well, look, if we're isolated and we can't, visit people and it's really difficult to get onto a maintenance program and if there's been a lot of blockages at the border, so there's not been any, none of the drugs have been able to get through, it makes it very difficult for people to see the same people they've been seeing all the time or get hold of medication that they require, the change in the legislation from the federal government's perspective so that really people are only getting their pain relief or enough maybe
amounts.
For a week in smaller amounts. Yeah. So, and if they can get it, which is hard enough anyway, it's very difficult to get that prescribed.
Yep.
So it's just not right.
Not a good situation.
No, and we're ending up with more people overdosing. Accidentally, inevitably, people don't mean to overdose, but good heavens, we're missing.
They leave behind
wrong.
Friends, family, kids, spouses, people that know them and love them. It's just devastating. I'm really tired of prohibition, Maren, to be honest.
It's exhausting, Geoffrey, and we'd say this every week. The news from the drug war front is that it's still the same. The war is still going. People are still dying. We're not maintaining, Geoffrey. We're not keeping things together. Every week we come onto the show, talk about the war on drug users and how many people we've lost and why we've lost them, and it just doesn't make any sense, does it?
No, not to me.
Just doesn't make any sense.
Not to me. I can't see a justification. Anyway, here's Johnny Winter, and this is, shout out to Donnie and his
memory. What was Johnny's brother's name? Because they both look very similar, didn't they?
Honestly, it slipped my mind, Maren.
Blonde and blue, blonde hair, long blonde hair and blue eyes, both of them.
No, a different fellow, I think. But
I thought that he had a brother that played with him. Anyway, maybe I'm wrong.
Oh, you mean Johnny Winter? I thought you were talking
about Johnny Winter. No, Johnny. Not Donnie, Johnny.
Edgar Winter, yeah.
Yeah,
he's
Edgar.
An albino.
Johnny
and
Edgar, that's right.
No, you completely
couldn't remember his name.
Yeah, no, Johnny and Edgar Winter. This is Johnny and this is Lay Down Your Sorrows from John Dawson Winter 3. All right, that was Johnny Winter and Lay Down Your Sorrows from the John Dawson Winter 3 album. Okay, it's coming up about 13 minutes to 11 and you're listening to News from the Drug War Front with Jeff and Marion. Marion, we've got a new story. Regular listeners will know we've had an ongoing series of women's stories.
Yes, women's stories from the, what is it?
Support Don't Punish.
And that's an ongoing women Harm Reduction International project that they've been sponsoring, and we've been requesting stories from women on their interactions with drug and alcohol services and to what extent they have been affected by them. And this story is by Fiona, and quite a good story and an impactful one too. The story by Fiona, it starts, "Keep them in the dark and punish them." If I could pick a slogan to express the essence, the nature and the operational principle of services that exist to help people who use drugs, that would be it. Quote, "Just keep them in the dark and punish them." I'm well aware that all these workers who deal with us, like medical professionals, caseworkers, child protection workers, community service workers, housing and Centrelink workers and numerous others, do not intend to keep us in the dark and punish us, but unfortunately that's what their actions look like, and that's the end product of their so-called service to us. Example one, my experience with methadone. I was very young when I went on the methadone program, but never really understood why some people get to go to pharmacies and pick up their done and get takeaways, while others, like myself, never get to that point. For many years, I had to go to the clinic every day to get dosed, which meant that, one, my everyday would start in a very unpleasant way by entering the clinic with high security system designed to protect workers from individuals like myself, dangerous and unpredictable, unstable, outcast of society. You can't feel like a decent human being after that. Two, I'd spend half of my day, of every day, travelling to that horrible place and back, after which I felt physically, mentally and emotionally exhausted and not capable of doing much with my life at all. Then three, I will miss my dose whenever I'm sick and not capable of leaving the house. For example, when having a cold or the flu, it also meant I'd miss my dose on holidays if I missed my bus or if I was outside the city at my partner's place where public transport did not operate on the holidays. Then another point, I would have to regularly participate in one of the most humiliating acts in the world, urinating in front of an unknown person in order to prove that I was compliant with the system and hadn't used any illegal drugs.
That was always one of the most degrading aspects, especially women that had to do it in front of a male.
Yeah, I mean, no, it's just wrong. After some period, this really gets too much, she goes on to say, especially in combination with mental health issues I struggle with since my childhood. It would get so overwhelming that I would usually quit, just drop off the program and go back to using drugs. I'm aware that using heroin is not freedom from methadone slavery, it's rather another type of slavery. But at least it gives me the illusion of freedom, feeling that I can do things my way, when I want and how I want. It's less humiliating, and although as a drug user you can't run away from stigma and discrimination anywhere, this gives you a break from being reminded every morning that you're just a cog in a system where discrimination is embedded in medical treatment meant to help you. But to get back to my point, some of my peers engaged in consumer representative groups explained to me that the main criteria for becoming eligible for takeaways is, quote, stability, unquote, something that doctors assess, asses, and make decisions about us based on what? Why nobody ever told me about this, ever? Why I had to wander in the dark, wondering what I should do and how I should be in order to get a break from having to dose every day, in order to get some space to breathe. There's no proper resource, pamphlet, poster informing you about, quote, stability you have to achieve in order to become eligible for getting takeaways. Neither your doctor has a proper conversation about it with you when you're in. Neither does your doctor have a proper conversation with you about it when you're entering the program. If someone had given me some guidelines for how to behave and what to do in order to become eligible for takeaways, I might have stayed in the program longer and achieved more. But no, instead of having straightforward communication with us, explaining what we should do, they rather keep us in the dark and then punish us for not meeting this so-called criteria that only they knew about, for not satisfying the requirements that we didn't know even existed. So example two, childcare and protection services. They took my kids because I used drugs. I fought for years to get them back. I did everything they asked, went back on methadone, got counselling, did parenting courses, gave my urine regularly for analysis. It wasn't enough. After all that, I asked them, "Can you please tell me what else I need to do in order to satisfy you and get my kids back?" They said, "We can't tell you that because once you know what we're looking for, you can pretend and fake it. You have to achieve things naturally. We can't risk being tricked." What kind of answer is that? So again, just keep me in the dark and keep on punishing me. After that, I realised I will never be able to get my kids back because in their eyes, I'll never be a good mother, whatever I do. That day, I gave up on everything, on methadone and on my kids, and went back to using heroin. So example three, buprenorphine. After losing a battle with Care and Protection Services about this is about the kids, it took me almost a decade to stop using again. Once again, I went on the methadone program, and over a year I decreased my dose to the bare minimum. Then my doctor suggested I could switch to Buvidal injection, which meant I would have to go to the clinic only once a month to get the injection and forget about it for a month. Sounded like heaven to me. He told me that it works great for some people and that it may be a huge plus in the eyes of Care and Protection Services if I want to get my kids back. They look really positively on parents who are on Buvidal.
Buvidal.
Beg your pardon. I've never come sorry, across no, it, yeah. Sorry. No, you're right, darling. I need to know what it is. I just decided to give it a go. But what my doctor didn't explain to me was that transition from methadone to buprenorphine can be extremely hard. And for people like myself, who could never do a cold turkey, it was unbearable. It didn't work for me. Small doses of bup in the first days of transition didn't hold me at all. And not being able to put up withdrawal, I simply went back to using heroin. I made a mistake of trusting my doctor. He said, "I'll be fine." I wasn't properly prepared. And when I had to reach him in the middle of withdrawal, the receptionist said the next available appointment was in 10 days. After that, I just called my dealer. He was there on the same day. Once again, I was kept in the dark and punished. I guess my point here is we people who use drugs do not get enough information to make informed decision about our health and our lives. We are always kept in the dark, not only because we stay in the shadows voluntarily, because we need to hide, but also because once we do decide to come out and ask for help, we get treated as criminals, frauds, manipulators who should not be given correct or sufficient information because we'll somehow twist it, band it, and use it to dodge the system. I have no solution for that. The problem is too big, too overwhelming and systemic. I'm just one broken individual, and this burden of injustice is too heavy for me. I don't feel like I can do anything to change things. The only thing I can do is take drugs and make myself feel a bit better. The price may be too high, but really, what else do I have left when I lost all battles anyway? That's
wow.
From Fiona.
What a
great
story.
Yeah, really good story.
I'd like to thank
Fiona
for that.
Yeah. No, that is a really good story. And it's absolutely perfect for our needs simply because it explains to you, and I hope I read it well enough for you, Fiona, But it's very difficult to get your emotion into my voice, especially when I know exactly what you're talking about. So sometimes I tend to go over, sort of jump the issues instead of explaining them. So if people aren't understanding, read it. It'll be on the webpage, Jeff, won't it? You'll put it on the website?
I'm pretty sure
Could
all
you?
The stories go up on the
website. Okay, so it'll be on the website. Anybody who didn't understand what this was about, probably not a woman for a start, but, you know, Jeffrey understands it, and he's not a woman. Well, not visibly anyway. So, so have a look on the website and have a look at this story because it really is worth reading. It has a lot of meaning to it. But the purpose and the intention of the story is quite clear. Keep us in the dark and punish us. And I really love that statement. We can't tell you what the criteria is for getting takeaways or for getting your children back because then you'll use it against us. If you know the rules, I mean, is that ridiculous or what?
Totally.
If you know the rules, you'll use them to bend, to manipulate the system. Now, how come it's okay for the system to manipulate us and for us not to reciprocate?
Well, it's part of the hypocrisy and the moralising of prohibition, Marion, isn't it, really?
This is the war on drugs. Is, you know, it's not only that, it's not just the war on drug use, it's the war on their children,
mm-hmm.
it's a war on their families, it's a war on their employers, if they're lucky enough to still be employed by the time someone finds out that they are on methadone or they're on using drugs of any kind. And yet you probably find that the majority of people that you work with or associate with, or the people in fact that are making you jump through the hoops that you don't know about, are using some kind of drug to get through the day themselves.
Absolutely. We're all
What's
human.
Coffee?
Yeah.
If that's
alcohol,
not something
cigarettes.
To get you going. Yeah, absolutely.
Pharmaceutical medication.
Yeah. And everyone's got something.
I thought one of the other great points you made, Marion, was where she talks about not being fully informed before you are offered opiate substitution treatment, whether it's methadone or buprenorphine. I know in my own case, there was no mention of the impact potentially on libido, which is a very important thing for all human beings.
Absolutely. Well, and not mentioned in here either, actually. In the story, but yes, you're right.
But for many men, and I would imagine women too, it is a reality. Also, the impact on potential weight gain, the impact on your teeth. There's a whole list of things that
were never mentioned. Your teeth and on your diet and on your... Well, not only that, and Fiona does refer to this, when you have to go and dose at the clinic every day, it takes you 3/4 of the day to get there and back. Depending upon where you live in relation to the clinic. You know, the buses, if you're living out in Gungahlin and you have to go to the hospital to dose, which is over in Woden.
It's a long trip.
Right?
Yeah.
It's an hour and a half there and an hour and a half back and then probably 3/4 of an hour, sorry, that's probably overstating it, maybe 20 minutes waiting for you to get it. Now, you're bound to miss the bus going back because it's not at an interchange. If it was an interchange, you could get a bus directly back to another interchange and then to another interchange.
And the weekends are even worse.
Weekends are a shock. Well, from my suburb, there's a bus every 2 hours.
Yeah, mine too.
That's just crazy.
Yeah. But so, thank you, Fiona, for that letter.
No, it was a fabulous story. No, I'm really impressed by it.
And we have a couple more yet to come. So I hope people are enjoying hearing these highly personal Very honest accounts of the impact, Okay, let's go to a song, a real classic and a favourite of the show. It's Walk on the Wild Side, Lou Reed. I think it's a good choice.
What's what we're doing, hey?
Absolutely. One of the all-time classics, Lou
good
Reed.
Good for Lou.
Walk on the Wild Side. Okay, it's about 4 minutes after 11. You're listening to News from the Drug War Front with Jeff and Marion in the 2XX studio, which, of course, is people-powered radio, 98.3 FM. We don't get too many stories from our southern fellow compatriots, Ireland, Tasmania, but this is a piece from a pharmaceutical journal from the staff. By the time he died, his local Kenmart pharmacy and the beach were the only two places visited by a Tasmanian man with mental illness who was on a methadone program. And it says, warning, this article contains details that may distress some readers. It's dated September the 15th. A coronial investigation into the death of a Tasmanian man has highlighted the issue of access to help for people with comorbid mental health and substance use disorders. Tasmanian coroner Olivia McTaggart found the man who the, and this is AJP, it's the Pharmaceutical Society's website, has chosen not to identify. He died due to the intravenous injection of foreign debris associated with drug use after crushing and injecting his prescribed medicines. The man had had a long and difficult relationship with drugs and alcohol, becoming addicted to cannabis and alcohol in his late teens and developing a severe case of kidney stones at 19, as a result of which he was prescribed pethidine. He subsequently became dependent on pethidine and started to also seek and use other illicit drugs, the coroner noted. At the age of about 20, he confided to his mother that he'd been sexually abused by a school teacher. This is often the source of people's dependency issues or self-medicating. While he did seek some psychiatric treatment, he did not continue with it. Mm-hmm. In 1999, he was admitted to the methadone program under the supervision of his general practitioner, and it was this GP's prescribing which was scrutinised by the coronial inquiry. The man had few personal relationships and was described by the coroner as having, quote, quite a reclusive lifestyle. He had no known friends when he died, only associated with people when buying drugs. Toward the end of his life, he could only visit the pharmacy for his medication and the beach, the coroner noted.
Mm. In late 2015, the man started using ice, and his mother said that this changed his behaviour for the worse. He also suffered suicidal ideation and presented to the hospital many times, saying he wanted to harm himself and others. The most recent hospitalisation for thoughts of harm to himself and others was in September 2016, only months before his death in January 2017. He was released into his own care with follow-up from his usual doctor each time. This doctor had supervised his daily methadone dosing from 2002. By the time he died, the man was in the process of reducing his intake of methadone, though he continued to use drugs including cannabis, benzodiazepines, amphetamines and opiates. His regular pharmacy, ChemMart, dispensed his methadone as well as the prescribed diazepam, pregabalin and quetiapine. As the man suffered from a number of conditions, including cluster B personality disorder, including delusions, anxiety, depression, COPD, asthma, GORD, recurring kidney stones, and chronic pain. The pharmacy was closed on Sundays, and so the man would collect a takeaway dose on Saturday as well as his regular dose consumed in store. The man had a long history of injecting takeaway doses, which the doctor and the staff at the ChemMart knew about and were monitoring. There had been a plan to switch him to Suboxone. On a Saturday in January 2017, he consumed his usual dose of methadone in store at the ChemMart and took away his Sunday dose as authorised. Around lunchtime the following Monday, his mother found him dead in his room and cold to the touch. A toxicological examination of a post-mortem blood sample found methadone, quetiapine, diazepam, mirtazapine, as well as THC or cannabis, but not the toxic or not in toxic or fatal ranges. The forensic pathologist who performed the autopsy found the man had crushed tablets intended for oral use and that his death was the result of intravenous injection of foreign debris, complicating chronic intravenous drug use. Insoluble foreign material, probably microcrystalline cellulose used as a binder, had become trapped within the small vessels of the lungs, resulting in acute pulmonary hypertension and death. The coroner found that the man's death was accidental. However, the case highlighted the issue of access to integrated care in Tasmania, as well as the problems that can arise when local pharmacies are not open every day to offer in-store dosing. The coroner noted that she had received a, quote, comprehensive report from the chief pharmacist, analysing relevant records of the pharmaceutical services branch, which was responsible for authorising the doctor to prescribe methadone.
Yeah. Now, the chief pharmacist expressed concerns that the doctor had contravened guidelines for the Tasmanian Opioid Pharmacotherapy Program by prescribing takeaway methadone doses for the man, despite his, quote, clear history of injecting drugs. Well, how else was he going to dose on Sunday, Marion, if
Absolutely.
The chemist isn't open?
Yeah. I mean,
this is one of the problems, not just in Tasmania, but in a lot of pharmacies and a lot of people.
Yep. That's so true.
The chief pharmacist also had concerns about him being prescribed, quote, concurrent, multiple sedating and psychotropic medications, concurrent and extended prescribing of benzodiazepines, and concurrent prescribing of other sedative and psychotropic medications, end quote. The coroner consulted a consultant psychiatrist and addiction medicine specialist who said that, quote, ideally, with the history of injecting takeaway doses of methadone, he should not have been in receipt of any takeaway doses of methadone. However, there is difficulty accessing seven-day dosing in Tasmania. Transport options are limited and there may be an increased associated cost of travel to go to an alternative pharmacy out of area. This needs to be taken into account in the rationale for continuing the Sunday takeaway dose as exceptional until the switch to the safer preparation of Suboxone Quick-Agir. Well, is that necessarily a safer? That's
Jeffrey,
a big jump.
The coroner said that the guy died from the crap in the tablets that he was injecting, not from an overdose of methadone.
But they always seem to focus on the opiate substitution.
They focus on the opiate,
always.
That's just ludicrous.
This specialist said it was understandable that the doctor prescribed multiple psychotropic medications given the apparent progressive deterioration of the man's mental state from the repeated exposure to ice and cannabis. She noted there had been a plan to reduce off the diazepam once the doctor had sought advice about managing this from the man's treating psychiatrist. She noted that the psychotropic medication was dispensed on a daily basis in an appropriate safety measure and the doctor had made repeated efforts to engage the man with a range of mental health services. She noted there are no specialised services for dual diagnosis in Tasmania. Well, I think this might be one of the problems, Marion. Lack of services.
Lack of services, full stop.
Yeah.
Hey? Not services peculiar to one person's case, but any services, I suspect.
Yeah, goes on to say a gap in service provision for people with both mental health problems and substance use problems. The specialist noted the doctor had provided a consistent therapeutic relationship, quote, in the absence of integrated care being available. The coroner accepted the treating prescribing for the man would have been difficult for the doctor and that he should not have prescribed takeaway doses, requiring the methadone only to be consumed orally at the pharmacy. He should also have noted the Pharmaceutical Services Board that the man was in the habit of injecting his takeaway doses, she said. However, while the man's death was due to crushing and injecting his other prescribed tablets, the coroner did not criticise the prescribing of any of these medicines.
Yeah.
So you're right, it's always putting the blame.
This is about the opiate replacement therapy. It's got nothing to do with what actually caused his death, which was the toxic little bits of crap that come with the pills that he was crushing and injecting. They were the things that got lodged into his veins and stopped the blood from getting through and keeping him alive. This is the war on people who use methadone now.
Yeah, injectors in Tasmania don't have access to wheel filters or extra equipment to make it safer.
Can we just say, by the way, for crisis support or suicide intervention services, call Lifeline on 131114 if that works for you.
Yeah.
Either that or you can always call Karma or any of the other drug and alcohol services. I have problems with this so-called dual diagnosis stuff anyway. You show me a person who is using any drugs whatsoever that hasn't got, dual diagnosis means somebody who has some kind of psychiatric condition as well as an addiction problem, right? And generally what that means is heroin plus psychiatric illness, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't, nothing else but heroin plus psychiatric illness.
Yeah.
And from my perspective, there are very few people who don't have an issue of some kind, however minor it may be. How many people do you know that have issues of anxiety?
Sure.
Yeah, I think anyone that's listening here, if you're at work, have a look around your office space and see if you can identify people who may have anxiety issues, because that's a psychiatric condition too these days.
In 2020,
right?
I'd say there'd be way more people suffering.
Yeah, I think, as I keep saying, you know, the last 12 months, particularly the financial year, the last financial year that we've had, if you're not suffering from some kind of anxiety, you're not thinking about what's going on in the world, and you sure as hell haven't been listening to Earth Matters.
Well, you're very lucky and, you know, special position.
But well, you don't know what psychiatric illness feels like, yeah, because you don't know what normal feels like. How many people don't know what normal is, Geoffrey?
I think that story highlights the problems in Tasmania. I mean, they don't have a funded drug use organisation. They don't seem to have much in the way of services.
And we have to also remember that they have one of the three legitimate opium plantations in the world, mm-hmm. the ones that have been approved by the United Nations. And one of the reasons for them being granted that was because they didn't have an issue of opiate use in the right. They used to say, when I was down in Tasmania, all the heroin users in Tasmania went to Victoria. Mm. They didn't. There
we
were
don't
none.
Have a problem.
There were none in Tasmania. We don't have a problem here. Yeah. They used to do the same in the ACT. Okay, we never had overdoses. People just stopped breathing. I mean, well, of course,
crazy.
That's how people do die. They stop breathing.
That's
strange,
right.
That. But yeah. Anyway.
All right. Let's go to a song. I picked Australian band The Triffids and "Wide Open Road." Okay, that was The Triffids and "Wide Open Road." It's about 20 minutes after 11, and you're listening to News from the Drug War Front on 2XX, Canberra's Community Radio, 98.3 FM, with Geoff and Marion in Studio 2 while we adjust to the new consoles and everyone getting trained and transitioning to the wonderful new digital era.
And any minute now I'm going to find out how to work those machines, so you look out for it. It'll be happening.
Awesome.
I'll know which buttons to push.
Marion and I mentioned earlier just about musing on the spate of overdose deaths where the COVID-19 had a role. And we've got a piece by Annalisa Morelli, who's a geopolitics reporter at QZ.com, and this is from September the 16th. And Annalisa says, COVID-19 and its corollaries of uncertainty, isolation and financial distress is a mix of high risk factors for developing a substance abuse disorder or relapsing. Overdoses have gone up while treatment centres are operating at very limited capacity and struggling to stay afloat. But it isn't all. That isn't all. New research published yesterday in the journal Molecular Psychiatry shows that substance abuse increases the risk of severe cases of COVID-19. Looking at the records of over 73 million patients in the United States, of whom 12,033 had COVID-19, the study found that those who had recently been diagnosed with a substance use disorder were significantly more at risk of COVID-19 than the average population.
That's an interesting concept, isn't it?
Yeah, I was unaware of that. Substance abuse is linked to a high prevalence of conditions that worsen the outcome of COVID-19, including asthma, hypertension, obesity, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. The increased risk was different depending on the substance. Opioid abuse was the greatest predictor for contracting COVID-19. Wow.
I would have thought being in contact with somebody with COVID-19 was the highest risk factor.
This is substance use.
Sorry, that was tongue-in-cheek. I was being facetious.
Sorry. Followed by tobacco, alcohol, cocaine, and then cannabis. This points towards substance use as an independent risk factor, unconnected to other diseases. Opioid users don't have higher incidence of coexisting conditions such as diabetes or hypertension than, say, people using tobacco, but they are at higher risk of COVID-19 infections.
That's interesting. I wonder if they're at risk of having longer lasting infections as well, because there are some people that seem to have symptoms for 6 months before they actually come back to feeling 100% again. Yeah?
So-called long COVID.
Yes. Anyway, it goes on. Overall, 10.3% of the total study population abused substances, but 15.6% abused, and we use that term very rarely, used substances, but 15.6% had COVID-19. And the likelihood of hospitalisation and death was higher among this group. When looking within patients with use disorder, gender didn't make a difference. but race did. As in the broader population, African American patients with a diagnosis of substance use disorder were at higher risk of COVID-19 than white ones. Is this an American?
It's American thing? Website, yeah.
Ah, okay. Makes sense. African American patients with a diagnosis of substance use disorder were at higher risk of COVID-19 than white ones. Overall, African Americans were at higher risk of both general COVID-19 related hospitalisation, and this discrepancy is even higher when COVID-19 is combined with a diagnosis of substance use disorder, both an older one known as lifetime or recent. While part of the higher risk may be due to the increased incidence of other conditions in the African American population, such as hypertension and diabetes, the authors of the study say that that alone doesn't explain the discrepancy, which could also be the result of difficult socioeconomic conditions and lack of access to health care.
Yeah, I think you can't leave that out.
That was probably what I was thinking about when we were even halfway through the article, was we're actually probably talking as much about localised conditions and where people are living and what conditions they're living in and their access to healthcare and to healthy meals, whether they're eating McDonald's or pizza or whether they're having a decent meal three times a day or even six times a day if you're having mini meals.
Yeah, no, it's crucial. You know, it's crucial.
And the healthcare is just unbelievable, access to healthcare, particularly among African Americans or amongst people of Latino, say, descent, people who have come across the border, right, illegally. They're not going to have any kind of healthcare at all because they're not registered, so they can't get insured for medical care unless it's provided by the place they're working at. And generally, they're working in conditions where, you know, they're illegally there, so they're not counted as being there, so they can get insurance, healthcare insurance.
Yeah, now COVID's exposed a lot of
situations. Yeah, it needs to be noted that this doesn't necessarily relate to Australian conditions, but it needs to be considered when we're talking about our Indigenous population too.
Absolutely.
Because I think the health of our Indigenous population is something that we need to be shocked about.
Mm. Couldn't agree more.
Yep.
Okay, we've got a piece. This is pretty distressing for our Russian colleagues.
Oh, absolutely. And something we very rarely hear much about, but because it's quite a long piece, but it's also a really interesting piece. We might stop halfway through and have a song.
Sure.
Do you think?
Yep, we can do that.
But we'll start off now and because it really is an interesting piece.
And it'll give you an insight into how tough it is in Russia.
Absolutely, how rough it is over there.
All right, this is entitled Russian Drug Users Describe Life and Trends During the Pandemic. It's by Alexei Lakoff and Matthew Bond from filtermag.org, September the 15th. Drug use is globally interconnected. Just thinking of the routes that illegal drugs take up to the point of consumption, from being grown or synthesised in producer countries, refined and produced in secondary locations, then often smuggled across borders and oceans, often makes you wonder, as a drug user, about people elsewhere in the world doing pretty much what you're doing. While the desire for different substances and their effects is near universal, cultural and political landscapes vary greatly, which was one reason we wish to present Russian drug users' experiences to Filter's readers, and also to our listeners. Russia infamously has some of the world's most draconian drug policies. As one study framed it, quote, "The government's official policy towards drug use is one of social intolerance, which seeks to legitimise and encourage societal ill-treatment of people who use drugs," end quote. Russian harm reductionists face severe restrictions and attacks on their work, including recent efforts to ban harm reduction publications as, quote, propaganda. Disgraceful.
Isn't it amazing? Propaganda is stuff that they don't want to hear about, not the stuff they produce, the stuff they don't want to hear about.
Exactly. It's in the eye of the beholder.
Don't be an opposition politician. No, you're at risk of poisoning.
Look at Alexei Navalny. Although, barely survived. Yeah.
Although they didn't do that. Russians didn't do that.
Of course not.
No.
People who use drugs face very harsh sentences, police brutality, and a fast-growing HIV epidemic, particularly amongst people who inject. Methadone and buprenorphine are banned. I'll say that again. They're banned. So there's no opiate substitution treatment in Russia. And syringe possession is often effectively criminalised. Certain populations, like the LGBTQ community, bear the brunt of such repression.
Well, they're banned too, aren't they, yeah, LGBTQ?
Pretty much, yeah. But another vital connection between the world's drug users is the solidarity and support that we all share, even while the pandemic prevents us meeting in person. Organisations like Input and Panda exemplify this, but less formal connections also proliferate. The two of us, for example, decided to collaborate after reading each other's work online. The issues faced by people who use drugs in Russia are underexposed in the West, and we wanted to hear from impacted people themselves. So we came up with a set of questions, translated them into Russian, and sent them to three women who use drugs in Moscow and St. Petersburg. We hope that their stories will serve as a reminder that all of us who use drugs belong to an international community that can become more powerful if we're truly united.
Oh, well, more power to these people, yeah, for doing this in the first place. The article goes on, the first question is, what has it been like using drugs in Russia during the pandemic? Sasha is a 22-year-old aspiring website designer in Moscow. She uses methadone and cannabis recreationally and is a drug user activist in her city. Quote, the supply of drugs on the market has decreased, Sasha told Filter, which made some substances very difficult to find, such as ketamine or cocaine. But my friends, who prefer methadone, did not notice much difference in the supply and price. For those unfamiliar, methadone, with many street names in different places, including, quote, White Magic, Meow Meow, M-Smack and M-Cat, is a strong stimulant in the amphetamine and cathinone classes. It's sold as fine white powder, perhaps a little yellowish, and can sometimes be identified by a foul smell, variously described as being like stale urine or exhaust fumes. Mixed with other chemicals, it's one of the components of varied substances well known in North America as bath salts. Masha, 35, lives in St. Petersburg, where she runs her own web shop selling cosmetics. She's dependent on street methadone. At the beginning of the pandemic, many, quote, shops, that's drug sellers on Telegram, an online messaging platform popular in Russia, were afraid that their goods, in quotes, would not be available, Masha told Filter. However, it was just as bad that there was no bus or mobile harm reduction service. And in general, I think people who are dependent on drugs just do not care whether there's a pandemic or not. They need to get their medicine, in brackets. Lilia, 22, also lives in St. Petersburg, using both illicit methadone and mephedrone, has her own channel on Telegram that's dedicated to people who use drugs. There, she goes by the nickname Mother of Salts. In fact, the difference is not particularly noticeable, she told Filter. In the early days of self-isolation, there were few people on the streets, and the risk of being seen by patrolmen was higher. But now it's business as usual.
That's interesting,
end quote.
It is. The next question posed was, what trends are you seeing in the illegal drug trade in Russia? Sasha is a fan of the dark web. In Russia, many sellers have begun stashing purchased drugs in geo-tagged hiding places for pickup, making in-person contact unnecessary. And Sasha has been one of the beneficiaries. During the epidemic, a very cool function of delivery appeared on Hydra, which is a Russian dark web marketplace, she explained. To use it, you need to pay 5,000 rubles, that's about $67, and the treasure, clad or stash of drugs, is placed as close as possible to the place that you indicated. The pleasure is not cheap, but perhaps such a trend is outlined in connection with the pandemic and lockdowns, end quote. She goes on to say product quality is declining, and in the case of opioids, it is consistently kept at a low level that is dangerous to health. Lilia's Telegram involvement means that she knows a lot about current trends in St. Petersburg and beyond. The market was filled with synthetic and semi-synthetic substances such as pyrovalerone, synthetic cathinones and methadone, she said. Product quality is also declining. In the case of opioids, it's consistently kept at a low level that's dangerous to health. In general, the situation across Russia is similar, but in regions close to Central Asia, more or less high-quality heroin is still found. There's less methadone and mephedrone there. Pyrovalerone prevails. Pyrovalerone, a cathinone that is occasionally prescribed in some European countries to treat chronic fatigue or to suppress appetite, is commonly mixed with methadone to create so-called bath salts. It's sometimes also altered and falsely sold as MDMA. People in Russia, like drug users everywhere, are well advised to check their drugs if they can find options such as mailing services. Sasha, Masha and Lilia all similarly reported that there's lots of mephedrone, methadone, cannabis, bath salts, synthetic cannabinoids, heroin and amphetamine available where they live. But interestingly, none of the three mentioned fentanyl.
That is interesting, isn't it? And how is law enforcement treating people who use drugs during the pandemic? The next question is. Sasha's in Moscow. She had a personal close encounter with the law. She quotes, "During the lockdown, I ran on the sidewalk at night and the patrol car noticeably slowed down before approaching me," she said. "I was lucky and they did not come out to inspect and examine me. But that night I saw this car several times." Lilia described cops' attitudes in St. Petersburg in a way that will sound all too familiar to North Americans. Quote, "Law enforcement agencies treat such people negatively, both during a pandemic and after that," she said. "The main thing is not to catch their eye," she continued, because that reminds me, we always used to drive along the road and say, "Look cool. Look straight."
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, it sounds like the same thing, doesn't it?
Just be cool.
Yeah, look cool. "The main thing is not to catch their eye," she continued, "because even if you do not have any illegal substances with you, the fact that you're a drug user will not only cause contempt for you, they may also plant drugs on you." Wow, sounds a tad like everywhere else, including the Philippines, doesn't it?
Hmm.
Another question, "Are there any harm reduction organisations in your area?" Sasha in Moscow acknowledged that she is a relatively privileged drug user, but noted that her city's stretched harm reduction services don't, therefore, prioritise her community. "Since my area is quite, quote, well off, that is, it's located close enough to the centre of the city, mobile harm reduction units don't come to us," she said. "Moscow is a big city and, first of all, the work of such organisations is aimed at the outskirts." Masha and Lilia in St. Petersburg both describe the work of Humanitarian Action, a harm reduction organisation that provides, among other services, a bus that brings syringes and other resources to drug users. In brackets, Filter recently reported on that organisation, and Alexei Larkov, co-author of this article, is its deputy director. And a new quote, "We have an excellent organisation which helps drug users a lot with access to distributing sterile syringes, ointments, bandages, alcohol wipes, harm reduction booklets, information leaflets about viral hepatitis, HIV and AIDS, overdoses and so on," Lilia said. "The organisation also helps those who wish to take rapid tests for hepatitis, HIV and syphilis free of charge and anonymously, and helps and supports everyone who goes there." That's the end of that quote. Despite the value of such services, in Moscow they are offered by Andrei Rykov Foundation, which last year launched an innovative chemsex program as part of efforts to improve LGBTQ outreach. They remain far too rare and under-resourced, and legal threats and limitation restrict all of their work.
Yeah, like you've got to admire the
absolutely
dedication.
Yeah. Although, look, this is interesting stuff, because what we're getting is, I guess, a middle-class view in a lot of ways, but it's very, it's contrary to the pictures. Remember, Jeffrey, those pictures we saw of people using crocodile with those horrible skeletal kind of, with the bones showing the skin? That looks like the propaganda that is being put by police. Government would be releasing rather than this stuff that we're hearing that's directly from users themselves saying, well, you know, bottom line is, it might be a bit tough on the outskirts, but if you're a middle-class user and
we're
they exist, you don't come into contact with services as much or as such, but we're there, you know, they're there and they are ready to reach out to other people. So, yeah, it's really interesting to hear that there are peers there and they're prepared to contact each other.
Mm, indeed. Last question is, what is important for the wider world to know about the drug user community in Russia? Sasha focused on the key issue of mental health. Quote, for me, the topic of mental health of people from the drug user community is becoming more and more relevant, she said. Many people needed help even before drugs appeared in their lives. Often people build relationships with psychoactive substances for the sake of self-healing, their state of mind. Mm. I think that in Russia, a very large proportion of the population is susceptible to mental illness due to the low standard of living and a very unhealthy family environment. Masha responded by talking about the inherent supply vulnerabilities caused by prohibition. Quote, everything has become very affordable, she said, and there are a lot of scammers because of this. There are a lot of, quote, one-day shops in Telegram Messenger that take your money and then just disappear. Just like in the, quote, good old days when people with whom you'd been using just took your money to go to the dealer and didn't come back.
That's everywhere. That's universal.
Yeah, that's
Jeffrey,
not just Russian.
Right? Yeah.
Pictures from the 90s are alive in the minds of Russian citizens. Then, drug users were dangerous and degraded human beings in their eyes. Lilia wanted to end by reminding us of the harmful stigmatisation of drug use, present throughout the world, but particularly pronounced in Russian society, thanks largely to government encouragement. Mm. Yet she struck an optimistic note about how this is changing at a societal level, if not at a policy one. Quote, people need to know that drug users are, first of all, people too, she said. Pictures from the 90s are still alive in the minds of many Russian citizens. Then drug users were dangerous and degraded human beings in their eyes. Now this situation, like the picture as a whole, has changed. Drug users are, in general, now seen as part of society.
Wow, yeah, like drug users as a fact. What a surprise.
Yeah.
That's great, Jeffrey. It's
good
really
piece.
Good to hear that, isn't it? It's just really informative stuff when... And as I say, as you know, as I was saying before, when the pictures that we saw were basically from, I guess, vision that we got from emergency services, yeah, from their outpatients at hospitals, where they were seeing people who had no access to their own doctors or any kind of healthcare, and were street users and using
pretty horrible
substances,
yeah,
and ending up with really nasty physical manifestations of that use.
Yeah.
At the end of this article, Alexei has been working in the field of harm reduction, HIV and viral hepatitis prevention for 10 years. He's general manager of the Harm Reduction NGO's Coalition Outreach, that's in Estonia, and deputy director of humanitarian action, that's in St. Petersburg. He's written about substance use, hepatitis and HIV for Russian media outlets, including RIA Novosti, AIDS Center and T Journal. He's in long-term recovery from substance use issue. He lives in St. Petersburg. Matthew is the program coordinator. These are the two authors, by the way, with the Canadian Association of People Who Use Drugs, that's CAPWD, and a national board member with the Canadian Students for Sensible Drug Policy, the CSSDP. He's a research coordinator, freelance writer, and current drug user. He lives in Halifax, Nova Scotia. That's interesting, isn't it, Jeffrey? Alexei is in long-term recovery from substance use issues, whereas the Canadian guy, Matthew, says he's a freelance writer and a current drug user.
Probably able
I wonder if long-term recovery is the same thing as current drug user.
Possibly, just being careful.
It just sounds like, what do you need to say
to protect
yourself at home?
Yeah, very sensible. Okay, let's go to a song. And,
yeah.
Oh, my God, the show's almost over, Mary.
It is.
This is
God, we can wrap it, can't we?
We can.
Yep.
This is The Doors and End of the Night. All right, that was The Doors and End of the Night. We're getting into the home stretch. I just want to mention before we end the show that the finger prick survey is on again at the NSP in Civic. I believe you get a $15 Coles card for the honour of having your finger pricked and giving up blood.
And answering a couple of questions, putting a bit of blood here, there and everywhere to find out about the status of your Hep C status.
But, yeah, it's on every year, isn't it?
That yes.
Particular one. Yeah, so it's on again if anyone is close to Civic and the...
And they did have a hiccup with the cards.
So I believe.
I don't know how people feel about the cards, about getting in. Frankly, I think it's a little bit rude. Not being trusted with real live money, nonetheless. being provided with a $15 Coles card. They had a little bit of a problem with it. They ran out of cards and people were being offered pieces of paper that constituted cards on a bit of paper, but you had to run them through your phone or activate them through your phone. And if you didn't have a phone that you, or if you weren't on the Interblog, then it, you know, you couldn't register the card and then therefore get the food. As the $15, get the $15.
Well, don't start it till you got the
card. But that hasn't happened.
Yeah.
I mean, they've changed that. They've stopped doing that. It was only because they ran out of cards. So now they've got the cards back again. Yep. So
it's
you'll get the cards.
Should be smooth again.
It. Yeah, I'll be hunky dunky.
All right. Look, we'll do as much of this story from Glasgow as we can, because it's saying Glasgow drug users and a member of parliament hail a life-saving van that actually defies United Kingdom law. It's from The Guardian, September the 20th, by Eva Livingstone. Former drug user praised for setting up a safe space for injecting in a city dubbed Europe's drug death capital. It's lunchtime on a sunny Friday and there are two queues on Glasgow's Parnay Street. At street level, PhotoWorks Gallery, one group waits to enter an exhibition of the work of Oscar Mazzaroli, famous for photographing the city's post-war working classes amid social upheaval and disillusion. Opposite the line forms outside a Ford Transit van emblazoned with the words, "Safe Consumption." As some of the city centre's drug-dependent population wait for access to take illegal drugs. Quote, "It's a lifesaver," said one visitor to the van, which is kitted out with sterile seat and table covers, needle bins, injecting kits and naloxone, used to reverse the effects of overdose. "Without it, I'd be using a dirty alley and stepping all over broken glass and old needles."
Mm.
A friend of his recently overdosed around the corner and had to be saved, he adds, pointing to an alleyway where a 17-year-old girl also died just days earlier. Why can they not just make this van legal? The question is a complicated one that has been at the centre of efforts to curb fatalities. In the city, dubbed Europe's drug deaths capital. Scotland's drug deaths rate is some three times higher than that in any other EU country, with the majority of fatalities occurring in Glasgow.
And it also used to be the capital of HIV, the centre for HIV, remember?
Well, anyone who's seen Trainspotting.
Yep. Yeah. Well, when I was visiting the Netherlands. Anyway, while the City Council, backed by the Scottish Government, has long called for the establishment of supervised drug consumption facilities in the city, these are interpreted as contravening the Misuse of Drugs Act 1971 and have therefore been repeatedly blocked by the Home Office. Quote, "My plan is to push the boundaries so that the official facilities where people can get proper help and support becomes inevitable," says Peter Cryant, a former drug addict who set up the van earlier this year. "While it ensures a clean environment safer than the street, an official facility could provide such services as wound care, signposting and treatment. Quote, this is not a magic wand and I can't do this forever. It's about forcing the change." Cry can't risk the rest by operating the van, which exists in a grey area of the law. While selling or assisting in the procurement or preparation of a legal drug is an offence, users of the van bring their own substances and prepare them alone. Quote, "People in Glasgow recognise the issues that the city faces with regards to drug injecting and drug-related deaths. And it's scandalous the Home Office continues to reject public health intervention, like the implementation of supervised drug consumption facilities," end quote, says Alison Thewlis, the Scottish Nationalist Party, SNP, MP for Glasgow Central. Quote, "In the absence of support from the UK government, it's hardly surprising that some have taken the matter into their own hands. However, it shouldn't be the case that citizens have to take risks due to the failings of the UK government ministers." The Home Office says its approach to drugs is clear. Quote, "We have no plans to introduce drug consumption rooms, or anyone running them will be committing a range of offences, including possession of a controlled drug and being concerned with supply of a controlled drug."
So don't look to us for any change.
Yeah, that's right. We're not going to help. But for people like William, 48, who exits the van after injecting cocaine, the facility is the difference between dignity and stigma and life and death. Quote, "It's the great thing he's doing here," he says of Crycant. "People keep dying in alleys and they're going to take drugs whether you like it or not. Here it's safe and it's clean and you can get a hit in private without the police or strangers walking by. Of course it should be allowed. Either you want people to die or you don't.
Says it all.
Absolutely. It makes perfect sense. And I remember having a look at Rotterdam. I know I've said this before. They had a using facility in Rotterdam. The facility itself was abysmal. It had toilet water running out the door. It was just a mobile facility, but it was in one place. It was right outside the cop shop. And it was just obscene.
Doesn't sound
how people could say it was a using facility and pretend that in any way it was dignified with overrunning overflowing toilets. I mean, it was just abysmal.
Yeah.
This sounds like a reasonable
thing. So
people bring their own equipment, they bring their own drugs. All you're doing is providing a venue. Now that, yes, may be against the law. That could be considered aiding and abetting, but it's civil disobedience. And I think that's a really absolutely. I want these people to stay alive until they stop or don't stop, but nonetheless become operational members of the community, as users do, if they are allowed to stay alive and be productive. They're actually quite good people. We're okay, you know.
Yep.
Believe it or not, we're all right people.
And you're dealing with citizens of your own country, for goodness sake, Mary.
Absolutely.
It's not like aliens from outer space.
Look, I get cross about Assad murdering people in his country. But what are we doing to drug users but murdering them by virtue of inaction, if nothing else?
Yeah. Well, continuing policy, which we know leads to outcomes, including...
That are totally... Not unexpected, though, Jeffrey.
No.
Just unwanted. Yeah.
Well, it's lack of care. It's lack of policy. It's lack of priority.
Lack of leadership.
Yeah.
Lack of interest.
Ignoring the evidence.
Yeah. Not in my... It's a NIMBY problem. Not in my backyard. Don't want one of those down here.
Yeah.
And it doesn't affect me because my children don't behave like that. Guess what, kids? Tell your parents.
Yeah. No, look, I think... People are going to be – people that did nothing and just stood by and continued prohibition are going to be judged very harshly by history.
Oh, history, yeah. Or history is going to actually tell people what really happened.
And rightly so. It's.
I wish they would,
It's appalling.
Well, we do it every week, Jeffrey. You know, if people are not recording it, they ought to be.
Yeah. Okay, well, that brings us pretty closely to the end. Do
we have Golden Brown?
Do we have Golden Brown?
Yahoo!
Just want to remind people of the Karma telephone number, 6253 3643. Open Monday to Friday, 10 till 4. You can drop in or call at any time.
Yep.
Staff will be there. Staff and volunteers. We've got a good...
good volunteer bunch. Or if you want to become a volunteer, get in touch and do come.
Call
also,
Karma. Yep.
Public radio is here for your use. 2XX is people-powered radio.
Yeah,
become a member. And please cite news from the drug war front if it's because you heard what we were doing and you thought, oh, well, I can do better than them. But join 2XX anyway.
Absolutely.
It's people-powered radio is a very potent force and showed its value, if nothing else, during COVID, did it not?
Absolutely. It was an essential service.
Nobody else could get in touch with people. But we could.
Yep.
Yeah. You couldn't do face to face, but we could communicate with people because we're sitting behind a screen. We're sitting in an area that we're not communicating with anyone else except our voices are being heard.
And we had COVID protocols. We were
absolutely,
doing all the right things to keep everyone safe.
And keeping ourselves safe at the same time.
Absolutely, and that's a good point to finish up on, I think.
Indeed. Keep yourself alive and stay safe, people,
absolutely.
Please. And look after each other as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's something that can be done in so many ways. Do the naloxone training, call Karma.
Yes.
Talk to Dave or Damo, do a brief intervention.
It doesn't matter whether you use opiates or not. Somebody you know uses opiates. You may not know it, but they do. You learn to do that training and you are equipped to save lives.
And that's a really potent thing to do. Yeah, well, how many other instances can you point to something where you can do a brief training program?
And 10 minutes and know how to how to save lives of people who probably haven't offended you at all in any way, just happen to have dropped Yeah.
And how great you feel to be able to...
Absolutely. I felt like a hero the first time I used it.
Yeah, me too. It's an extraordinary really, feeling.
Yeah, it is a great feeling, yeah.
And
Not only that, they owe you.
and avail yourself of the opportunity. Karma's
absolutely.
Very
it's
proud
a very
of
potent
the same
thing.
Program.
It's a great program, believe me.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, that's it for another week's News from the Drug War Front. Marion and I will be back same time next week.
Same time next week, and we'll be happy to see from you and hear from you in the meantime.
And don't forget the Facebook page if you want to give some feedback, topics you'd like us to raise or cover, interviews you'd like us to try and get. Once everyone's trained in the new equipment, it'll be much easier to do phone interviews from anywhere.
And all we have to do is become brave enough to do it, Jeffrey.
Indeed. All right. Take care, everyone.
Look after yourselves and each other. Yep.
Yeah,
absolutely. Bye-bye, darling. Love
and
you.
We will be back next week. Thanks
Bye,
again,
everyone.
Okay, we'll leave you with the theme song, Golden Brown by The Stranglers. Bye for now.